This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 25th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. On the show this week, we sharpen our pencils and dip our pen nibs as the now Royal Drawing School reveals its new title and brand.
It's about bringing drawing, which has been done for thousands of years, together with the centre of the art scene and just doing it in a way that's totally contemporary and outward-looking, forward-looking.
We go to Mexico, where one American graphic designer left an indelible mark on the image of the country's sprawling capital city.
The station name Chapultepec means chapulín, or grasshopper. So instead of using the word Chapultepec, he used the icon of a grasshopper to mark that stop.
Plus, we go to a flea market on the hunt for some rather fine men's clothing and accessories.
It's a niche, quite a niche market that we're supplying, but it really is for people that appreciate good quality cloth.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, to start the show, one of London's youngest and yet already most important art schools got an added boost into the limelight this week when it got the Royal Seal of Approval. Announced and endorsed by none other than His Royal Highness Prince Charles, the school, formerly known as the Prince's Drawing School, opened only 14 years ago, and it was made the Royal Drawing School, joining the ranks of the Royal Academy, the Royal College of Art, and the Royal Ballet School, which was the last such institution to be made regal in 1956. Good news, but begs the question, how do you rebrand and rename an entire school, especially one with such grand associations? I caught up earlier with Julia Balchin, Head of Education Management, Marketing Communications, who worked on the rebrand, and Emily Howarth Booth, one of the school's teachers, to discuss all.
The school was founded in 2000 by an artist, Catherine Goodman, and His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. And I think really it acknowledges the work of our students and alumni, the strength of their work, and also the work of the teachers over the past 14 years. But perhaps more importantly, the bigger picture beyond the school itself is really the importance of drawing within the art world. And it recognises that there is a need, a permanent need for the teaching and practice of drawing and a place that will do that.
And it's an incredibly young school. And I mean, just ordinarily young, but also, you know, to have this title bestowed upon you. I mean, it's a big step. You know, I think what was the last thing to be made royal was the Royal Ballet School, wasn't it, in the 50s. It's an incredible honour.
Yeah, I think it really recognises the work of the students and tutors and the excellence of what we've been doing, continue to do. So in a way, it changes nothing because we're still just drawing.
Yeah,
but also, I suppose, in the public view, it just gets us out there a bit more.
Absolutely. And talking about getting it out there in the public realm, I mean, let's talk about how, you know, it's not just a title change, it's all the changes on all the print collateral and business cards and websites and things. How, I mean, it's been 10 months?
10 months in the making.
Talk me through some of the challenges of what it's like to sort of be rebranded.
Well, I think with the brand, obviously, as we were saying, it was a coming of age for us. So we wanted to look at our brand and we needed something that was perhaps a little bit more grown up, that reflected the sophistication that goes along with the title Royal. But perhaps most importantly, obviously we're a drawing school. So whatever you have for your logo, which is obviously going to involve a royal crest, it has to be drawn well. So I think that was the biggest challenge, was to make sure that our new logo was drawn well. We went to John Morgan Design Studio, who had done all of our branding previously. So we already had that narrative with us. He was really familiar with our brand. And he recommended our Chris Warmill, who he drew the Royal Opera House crest for them. And so he drew our crest, and it was quite interesting. Sort of Prince Charles fed in some ideas and said that he really wanted the elongated fleur-de-lis form of the crest. And we went to there's a very special man called the Garter King of Arms. And so he's in this building in Blackfriars, And the Garter King of Arms has been in position since the 1500s. And since then, there's only been, I think, 40 people who've held the post. So it's really a job for life. And you go in there and even the wallpaper is covered and all the coats of arms and all the crests. And he gets out these big dusty books and you go through all the stories of the different crests and the full achievement. And he was so, you know, such an exciting man. And he was so proud to tell us that the room had been featured in a James Bond movie on Her Majesty's service. And I think in the movie, he goes to see the Garter King of Arms and he draws a sort of fake family crest for him. And the motto on it is, "The world is not enough," which obviously then becomes the later title of a following James Bond movie. So the whole process has been sort of steeped in history, if you like. But I think that was the challenge of the brand, is how do you mix something that is steeped in history with something that is part of the contemporary art world? And that's very much, I think, a key message of what the school is about. It's not that we're trying to preserve drawing as something that belongs to the past. It's that we really believe that through the teaching and practice of drawing, you allow drawing to evolve within the contemporary art world. So I think the sort of crest alongside this very modern font, which is called Vimta, and that was designed by Monochron, who are a Norwegian typographers. I think putting those two things, the old and the new, together, this sort of old English crest next to the Scandinavian font, I think that sort of very much defines what the school's about.
Yeah, and I think as a designer, John Morgan has always understood that, and that's why we've been able to trust him with this job, because our existing branding before this rebrand was an Arnhem font, which is this lovely serif, quite traditional font, but he used it in the most contemporary way with these really eye-popping, bold, bright colours that is often slightly clashing and really unexpected coming together of these two ideas, which is exactly what the school is about, bringing drawing, which has been done for thousands of years, together with Shoreditch, the centre of the art scene, and just doing it in a way that's totally contemporary and outward-looking, forward-looking.
Yeah, because I guess in a way, you know, being given the title Royal, it can, I think, probably send out an idea to the public of it being quite stuffy and it being sort of, you know, paint, where sort of the great minds go and sort of draw in pencil and that sort of thing. But, I mean, you in particular, Emily, you work in comics and graphic novels, don't you? There is, you know, there's the modern side to drawing that's incredibly contemporary and young, which I think a lot of people might not know about the drawing school.
Yeah, that's right. There is a really contemporary side to it. I mean, I think drawing itself is contemporary. It's the nature of drawing that it's about looking in the now. And so it has to be fresh. It has to be contemporary if it's true drawing, if it's really about looking at the world around you, which is what we do. It's observational drawing. So I think all our drawing is contemporary. But I suppose the course I run, which is about comics and graphic novels, is particularly so, in that graphic novels are a kind of new thing in that they're now being seen as a medium rather than a genre. So they're not about superheroes anymore. They're kind of really expanding really rapidly. And in the last 5 or 10 years in England, the scene has just grown massively. Yeah. And I think the school's been part of that in its own way. We've got lots of fine artists who come through the school, and we've got our postgraduate drawing year programme, which is a lot of painters on that course and sculptors and people who've never thought about drawing comics, but they see it on the programme. They think, drawing a graphic novel, might as well try that. And then they find that there's something there for them, and that they've got a story to tell, and that they can do. People who might not necessarily think of themselves as writers, I guess, realise they can tell a story. And so that kind of message just spreads and spreads. And then we've got people coming in from outside as well who are starting to be interested in comics, like anyone from young illustrators to guys in their 30s who've always loved comics and grew up reading superheroes, to kind of retired mums whose daughters lent them a copy of Persepolis, or who like Posy Simmons. You get all those people coming together and just making comics, and it's brilliant. It's really exciting.
Could you tell us about the school itself? I mean, it is incredibly young, but you've already got, I think, 3 sites in London. Is that right?
We've got 5 studios across London.
Wow.
And it was about 4 years ago, we just really had 2 studios in Shoreditch. So our sort of hub, the main studio, is in Shoreditch on Charlotte Road. And it's in a old Victorian warehouse that was a fur factory. And our studios are up in the eaves. So you have these amazing sort of beams and windows on either side. And then we've got studios on the top floor of the T building. So that's brilliant for all of our postgrad students to be around all the different designers and creatives who are also in that building as well. And there's been lots of collaborative projects with, say, Poke London. We did something with them and they were auctioning off online auction of all of our students' work, which was to help raise money for the kids clubs that we have, which are for 10 to 18 year olds. That's another component of the school. It was David Hockney came to visit our postgrad students, and this was about, I think, 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, 2007.
Yeah. And he said, what you're doing here, I think, is really great, but you're getting them too old. You know, you need to start younger. So, you know, whether you're an absolute pro or a total novice, you know, we put everybody together in the same room.
Yeah.
And it's really about, you know, learning to see your world around you differently, and then how you translate this 3D world onto the 2D page.
Yeah.
And actually the Oxford Street Studios, we've just got really kindly through a charitable donation from the Weston family, who are the owners of Selfridges. Mm-hmm. And we're in the same, so we're opposite Selfridges, and in the floor below us is their creative team. So they've started coming on the courses as well.
Fantastic.
And we do this at like an early morning life drawing class. So the idea is you go to a yoga class before work to sort of concentrate your mind. The idea is you come and you have this quiet concentration before you go to work and sort of expand your mind before going into your day's work.
That was Julia Balchin and Emily Howarth Booth from the newly monikered Royal Drawing School talking to me there. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris, and now we go to Mexico City. One of American graphic designers Lance Wyman's most iconic works, the logo of the Mexico 68 Olympic Games, marked a time of social unrest in the country, which many have compared to the current protests against President Enrique Peña Nieto. Perhaps ironically, the first retrospective entirely devoted to Wyman's work is hosted in one of the hotspots of the current demonstrations, UNAM, the National Autonomous University of Mexico. The exhibition aims to highlight the relationship between Wyman's designs and urbanism, be it Mexico's subways, Canada's pedestrian skywalk systems, or the Minnesota Zoo. We sent Daphne Denis to explore Wyman's relationship to the Mexican capital.
His name doesn't evoke Mexico quite as much as Frida Kahlo's or Diego Rivera's, and yet Mexico residents know Lance Wyman's work just as well, if not better. Here, in the city's metro, Wyman is everywhere. He's the man who designed the icons representing each stop, all symbols rather than words.
Él para nombrar cada una de las estaciones del metro no usa las letras.
The icons of the metro were very important because he decided not to use letters to name the metro stations, and that's a big change. He was working for the Olympic Games. He was a foreigner, and he struggled to say station names like Candelaria de los Patos. And for instance, the station name Chapultepec means chapulín or grasshopper. So instead of using the word Chapultepec, he used the icon of a grasshopper to mark that stop. And around the area of the aqueduct, he used a sign with arcs. In La Merced, which is famous for its markets, he draws a stand covered in oranges, which is a Mexican way of displaying products.
Que es donde están los mercados, bueno, usa este guacal con naranjas, que es la manera también en que en México se muestran los productos, ¿no?
So those symbols were very simple. They used color, which also helped assimilate certain symbols with a shade and helped people transit through this new underground city.
Pilar Garcia is the curator of Coming and Going, the first exhibition entirely devoted to Wyman's work. The retrospective aims to highlight how his designs have entirely transformed urban systems through branding and wayfinding, a graphic designer's way to convey easily digestible directions to travelers through visual cues and landmarks.
He comes in 1966, when Mexico since the 50s had been experiencing a big development boom. The way the city looked, the geography of the city had changed a lot. We'd built the beltway, the viaduct, the Tlalpan Avenue. So the city was new and needed a new iconography, new landmarks. And Lance Wyman arrives as part of the European School of Thought that says those buildings must indeed become visual landmarks of the new city.
Estos monumentos fueran como puntos de referencia para las nuevas ciudades, para el desarrollo de estas nuevas ciudades.
Wyman arrived in Mexico at a time when graphic design was barely developed there,
and perceived as a purely two-dimensional craft. By turning his logos into sculptures or monumental symbols, he completely changed the way Mexicans perceived urban icons.
Bueno, lo que también es muy importante, que creo que es muy significativo en Lance, es que él estaba, él era...
What I think is really important with Lance is that he studied industrial design. And I think that his background in industrial design helped him conceive a third dimension in his projects. When he arrived in Mexico, you couldn't study graphic design. The Ibero-American University only launched graphic design studies in 1969. And before then, designers were artists and painters.
Y antes en México, quienes hacían el diseño eran como un linaje de artistas, de pintores. Entonces, bueno, Lance,
so Lance, who was an industrial designer, was able to conceive his work in three dimensions.
En un espacio de tercera dimensión.
Before mapping out the underground system of the Mexican capital, Wyman gave it one of its biggest branding wins. The logo of the 1968 Olympic Games, which played with the geometry of the five Olympic rings and the number 68, managing to ally modernity with a quintessentially Mexican identity and a touch of traditional art.
Él está pensando en el arte óptico y está pensando en una exposición que hubo en el MoMA antes de venir a México. Él desarrolla el...
He was thinking about art after seeing an exhibition at MoMA just before coming to Mexico. And he had developed a logo in 2 weeks, which means that he had no time to go see pre-Hispanic art. So the other people coordinating the project had the idea of using this symbol and combining it with traditional Huichol art. They asked the Huichol artist to add color to Lance Wyman's logo. So it's a mix of influences which was very much needed politically and culturally in 1968, having a logo that was modern enough and Mexican enough.
Un logo que fuera lo suficientemente contemporáneo, pero también lo suficientemente mexicano.
Coming and going isn't only about Wyman's Mexican endeavors. The exhibition presents a reproduction of his famous reindeer-shaped M for the Minnesota Zoo, his Penn Station signs, and other projects in the US and Canada. But it's only fair that Mexico is the first host of this retrospective, a sign of his lasting influence on the capital's urban design. For Monocle, in Mexico, I'm Daphne Denis.
That was Daphne Denis bringing us that report on the exhibition of graphic designer Lance Wyman at UNAM in Mexico City. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where we'll be back after this short break.
For Monocle's 2014 Travel Top 50, our correspondents have journeyed far and wide by road, rail and sea to compile the best ways to travel and what to do when you arrive.
Hotelier André Balazs chose our home turf of Marylebone for his first hotel venture outside the US. Despite Balazs' reputation for placemaking, few could have predicted the success of the Chiltern Firehouse, which has since become the go-to haunt for after-work drinks and client-schmoozing dinners.
Buckle up and join us for our annual rundown, Monocle's 2014 Travel Top 50, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Next up, it's time for our regional roundup of design stories making waves in one part of the world. And this week, it's Hong Kong's turn. To discuss the design headlines in the Asia-Pacific region, I am pleased to say I'm joined on the line by our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears. Aisha, let's start with not many design stories that come out of Hong Kong that regularly, but it's the big week coming up, isn't it?
It is. So as you say, Hong Kong is not necessarily regarded as one of the world's international design capitals. We do have a lot of rather beautiful skyscrapers. Architects are always clamoring to get a job here in Hong Kong because it normally means quite a lot of money. But it's not really a place that you see great young creative talent coming out of it. But this week, or next week, the first week of December, is when the Business of Design Week is held annually. It's been held here in Hong Kong since 2002. It's a Hong Kong invention. It's organized by the Hong Kong Design Center. And it really is a highlight for Hong Kong's creative community through the year. Rather than focus on product, it's not really a trade show. It's a week that's going to bring together people from all across the world, across all sorts of fields of design, to talk about both design and business and encourage the development of the creative industries as a whole.
Mm. What I think's so interesting about this is that there are so many design weeks and design fairs around the world. Every city's got one, it seems. But actually, Hong Kong's really nailed identifying what they can bring and what the city can bring to the sort of global design community and doing something a bit different. What can one expect from Business of Design Week? What goes on during it?
Well, one of the interesting things is that each year Hong Kong pairs up with a nation state. So last year it was Belgium, the year before that it was Denmark, and this year we've got Sweden working with Hong Kong. They also worked with Hong Kong on the 2004 Business of Design Week. So what it means is you're going to see a lot of Swedish principles of business in design coming and interacting with Hong Kong businesses and Hong Kong designers. And one of the most anticipated talks is going to be between Marcus Engham, who's the head of design at IKEA, and Rem Koolhaas, and also William Toh, who's a very influential figure here in Hong Kong. He oversaw the redevelopment of Police Married Quarters, which is a beautifully restored building here that's kind of embodying what Business of Design Week has in terms of its annual principles. It's a place where both international showrooms and local showrooms have set up shop. It's a place for commerce. It's also a place for studios and workshops. And so there will also be events at PMQ which will go alongside this Business of Design Week.
How sort of evident is Design Week in Hong Kong when it happens? I mean, you know, in London or Milan, you really get the sense that the whole city sort of gets behind it and notices it. But design, as you say, is quite a small part of public life in Hong Kong. Is it a time when actually the whole world or the whole city sort of takes notice of the industry, or is it just sort of happen in a convention centre and no one really takes any notice?
It's sort of between those two points, Tom. It does take place in the convention centre. The convention centre is in the middle of Wan Chai, which is a very central area of Hong Kong. So in that sense, it's accessible. There's lots of advertising up, marking Business of Design Week. But this isn't a design city. There is an attempt, and I guess a changing tide, to make it more of a design city. We've got more private museums having opened rather than just galleries, commercial galleries. There is a much anticipated public design and art museum opening up in probably about 4 years. So people do know it's happening. One of the things that goes alongside Business of Design Week is something called Detour, which runs a little bit longer than the conference itself. And it's an attempt to showcase Hong Kong as a hub for young and innovative creative design. And that this year will be held at the Police Married Quarters, PMQ, as it's known, this restored building in the heart of Central. And you'll see an international mix of talent with local workshops, installations and shows. There's obviously a huge representation of Swedish design, Swedish pop-up shops. University of Gothenburg is coming and bringing a few professors and students to show how design can help children. So there's a number of things going on, and all of this will be open to the public in an attempt to get Hong Kongers more involved with contemporary design and the business of it.
And from design to fashion, and another sort of big show that's just kicked off in Hong Kong, which is Pradasphere. It's your turn now, isn't it?
Exactly. So Pradasphere, which had its debut in London, as I'm sure you know, in May, came to Hong Kong last week. It's the opposite to Business Design Week. Everybody in Hong Kong knows about Pradasphere, A, because it's Prada and it's Hong Kong and everyone loves to shop and everybody loves Prada, but B, because Prada has taken over the roof of Pier 4 and the central piers, which are the piers that are on right on Hong Kong Harbour next to the Star Ferry Pier. I mean, it's a very, very blatant part of Hong Kong's skyline. They've mounted a huge Pradasphere box on top of the piers in which they're staging this exhibition of a showcase, which apparently Mucha Prada is very keen to say is not a retrospective. It's about the themes of her work that continue to go through even through to today. So Prada nerds are seeing shoes that they loved from 10 years ago, as well as the shoes they loved from last season. There's a few film elements. It's pretty much a carbon copy of what was seen in Harrods this past spring. And the only new part of it is that there's been a book, a quite beautiful large red book that Prada have made to go alongside this exhibition here in Hong Kong.
And any particular highlights from the show that you've particularly like?
Well, the opening party itself was pretty memorable. I think most of Hong Kong couldn't remember it the next day. It was that good a party, which is, I think, good for Hong Kong. The show itself has a beautiful interior. There's a Verna Panton silk and velvet green upholstered Verna Panton room at the back of the exhibition, which sounds quite horrific, but actually is beautiful.
No,
kind of sitting over the harbour. Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It's like this kind of dream apartment. And within it, there's an incredible cabinet called Feminine Masculinity, which is this kind of incredibly androgynous Prada looks, which I personally quite like.
Crikey. And lastly, let's talk about a big jade buffalo that's got your attention.
Well, there's not many times when I think we can talk about a large jade water buffalo on Monocle 24, so I thought this would be a good excuse to do so. It's kind of auction season at the moment in Hong Kong. The autumn auctions are being held by Christie's and Bonhams. Christie's have taken over a large part of the convention centre, which will next week become where Business Design Week is. And Bonhams have their own space here in Hong Kong. And on the 27th is the auctioning of a magnificent, this is, I'm quoting Bonhams here, a magnificent and important large green jade carving of a water buffalo, which apparently, if anyone out there is really interested, has a special niche for water buffalo carvings, it's going to fetch somewhere between 1.5 and 1.9 million US dollars.
God, just in time for Christmas. Perfect. Aisha Spears, Hong Kong Bureau Chief, thanks very much for joining me on Section D. Thank you. You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where I'm bringing you Section D, our dedicated design show. Still to come today, we'll be joining a gathering of designers as they discuss visualising information, open up the rather wonderful new passport issued by Norway, see why Paris is not going up in the world, and do a bit of shopping at Pop-Up Flea in London's Shoreditch. As design-minded, devoted listeners to Section D, you'll agree that a picture says more than 1,000 words, and know that sometimes a well-designed graphic can explain complex structures better than any text, no matter how well written. Visualised I.O., the Conference for Infographic Design, made its first visit to London last weekend after starting in New York and venturing on to Berlin. For Monocle, Max Koschik went to the London event, which was held at the studios of Protein in London's Shoreditch.
I have a belief. I am a designer with a belief. And I think that we as humans are visual learners, and we've always been visual learners. And if you are using data and information to convey stories, and if you pack them into visuals, then people are able to learn better, to understand better, to gain knowledge from it, and possibly at some point, maybe that will trigger some sort of a change, whatever that change would be. My name is Moral Porkazemi. I am a graphic designer, but I focus on visualizing information and data. I am also the organizer of the Visualize I.O. conferences. So far, we only had two. And of those two, I was the organizer. I hope that other people will take this concept into their cities.
What is the role of Visualized and the conferences in the process?
I personally love Visualized. I got there as a speaker first, and for me, it became a space for finding new friends, finding new colleagues, and also bringing new people to as well, and to cater a space for people from the huge data visualization spectrum in general to come together. And not only pick one part of it, but cater everybody.
It's William Rowe, founder, CEO of Protein. We are the sponsor and venue host. We've been, long-time friends and family of Visualize since the first one.
What drew you to Visualize in the first place?
Data and visualization, adding the element of storytelling. It just brings a completely different approach to it that's less geeky, less noodly, and actually a lot more accessible. But I think most recently, David McCandless's work, he's a journalist. He works for The Guardian, and he's trying to crunch really complex stories. And the Billion Dollar Gram, which I think is its most famous, certainly one of the most famous, in terms of treating the size and scale of where money, or government money, is spent, and visualizing that is phenomenally successful in terms of the relation of what was spent on the Gulf War to the NHS, big box, little box. And that, in its simplicity, is profound.
My name is David McCandless. I'm a London-based data journalist and information designer.
Your work is actually the one reference point that always people come back to. So when people talk about information design, visualized data, the one book they reference is yours, or your two now. How did you come to this?
I started visualization kind of unexpectedly. I had a bit of epiphany. I had been a print journalist for many years, writing articles. One day I'd been struggling with a very complex article, and in order to keep track of all the different aspects of it, I drew this little sketch, a little diagram. And I remember looking at that sketch and thinking, hold on, that had actually done the job, my job as a journalist, in conveying my understanding of this subject. And that made me think, maybe I could draw diagrams instead of write articles.
Do you think because it's been so popular that maybe some people don't do it that well? They maybe also not accurate, or they're also in their craft of design?
Yeah, I think visualization is a discipline. And you could say maybe that some people are more disciplined than others when it comes to producing this kind of material. I think online, luckily, I think the good work surfaces to the top. But there is a lot of average work that goes around. And I think that can create a bit of ennui and people can get a bit put off by the scene. But the thing about information design is it either works or it doesn't. So a really good piece, you look at it and you're captivated and you're informed by it, it works. And if it doesn't, if the piece doesn't work, then it's failed. So you won't look at it and it won't spread it and you won't disseminate. So it's a self-fulfilling, self-propagating medium, really.
I think we are experiencing a trend with David being one of the first people who actually touched upon this field. This is why he's an icon. He has set the first steps and many others are following that. And for him also not actually being a designer makes him as a person really, really interesting, and also as a person behind the projects really interesting. I think that the next step for this scene is to figure out, to continue the conversation into bringing these interactive and static visualizations into something that causes more engagement with the people that are actually engaging with it. Your viewer, what do you want from that viewer? What do you expect that viewer to take away from your visualization? Everybody's aware of the power of visualizations. And there are more and more different fields that are coming together in the field of data visualization. We heard a little panel discussion with human rights organizations here. They have never visualized their data, but they have now, through this little workshop that we hosted, experienced some sort of enlightenment of what visualization and the whole process behind it is able to deliver. A lot more different sciences will come together. A lot more different fields and experts will speak with each other. And that's a great power of visualization.
That was Max Koschek meeting some of the participants of London's first visualized I/O infographic design conference. This is Monocle 24 and you're listening to Section D. After announcing its new sleek banknotes with modern pixelated images just last month, Norway is now presenting its redesigned passport, the winning proposal of a nationwide competition. The new document, due to come out into effect in 2017, features simplified drawings of Norwegian landscapes, which change under UV light. It also comes in three colours, depending on one's status. Responsible for the document's design are the creatives behind Oslo-based Neue Design Studio. And Monocle's Marcus Hippie caught up with Guru Kvame, managing director at the establishment.
There's always a practical dimension where user needs, and in this case also safety reasons, require change and innovation, also in the public sector. And that was basically the reason for why the Norwegian police directory needed to do something with the passports. And I would like to mention that their client, from the start, emphasized that we're looking for a really strong and clear concept. They were really conscious about using power of design to create something different, but still could meet a long list of high and strict functional requirements. So we started with, like we always do, treat this as a normal project, really maybe a bit disrespectful of the valuable document it actually is. But we always seek really, really hard to find the essence. It's always there. It's so close to your eyes sometimes it's hard to spot. So we were looking for something that was really, really into the Norwegian roots. When we started to dig, we found the Norwegian landscape. And that's what really was the starting point for the concept.
And what were the limitations for your design? So what can you actually have in a passport and what can't you have in a passport?
The limitations were really, there were a long list of criteria, more than limitations, and that's really what was different from this project to other similar public tender competitions. It was really open, and they were looking for something that could both have identity, be an identity carrier, as long as meeting really a long list of strict and functional requirements. So they were really open, more than limited.
What kind of reaction have you got? What kind of feedback have you got from the Norwegian audience?
Both from abroad and from the Norwegian audience, it's amazing. It's, of course, highly appreciated, all the recognition, both for Norwegian Design Studio, but also for Norwegian design in general. And I would like to say that there are many reasons that look to Norway as a statement, and I'm happy to finally add design to the list.
And passports aren't the only national symbols that have got international attention for their new modern design. Also recently, Norges Bank released a design for the new Norwegian banknotes. And here we go again. Again, very impressive and modern designs there. What's going on over there in Norway now?
I think the public arena is starting to understand the true value of design, for a start. And then we have a long tradition in Norway to believe in presenting design which is pure, simple, very clean expression, minimalism. And I think the combination of the needs to do something in a different manner in combination with our long tradition for design is time to market. It's just happening. And basically also because the audience, both the client side and the public, they are starting to understand that it actually works. It's measurable and it creates a difference.
That was Monocle's Marcus Hippie talking to Goril Kavame at Oslo-based Neue Design Studio. This is Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll return straight after this.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Hello and welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now we head to Paris, where perhaps unsurprisingly for this architecturally rather conservative city, plans for a new building have been rejected. The offending issue was predominantly the height of the proposed Tour Triangle, designed by architects Herzog and de Meuron. Councillors narrowly voted to veto the tower, showing that Paris's skyline, dominated by that other most famous of towers, is not up for discussion. However, Parisians have joined the debate like never before, and the city's mayor has even stepped in. To find out more, I spoke to our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson.
It was meant to be a towering, great 180-metre-tall triangular tower just on the edge of the 15th arrondissement of Paris, and it would have towered far above anything else in the area. It would have gone up in the year 2017, so just in a couple of years from now, mainly glass and steel. And the pictures that you see of it in its proposed state are all of it very much illuminated, looking rather beautiful and glittering. But in context, it would have been several times higher than the nearest tallest building in that particular part of Paris, next to the Porte de Versailles, which is often used for exhibitions and so on, and the sort of the salons that you see in Paris very often. So I think there was a sense that perhaps it would have looked a little bit odd in that particular corner of the French capital, and perhaps that's one of the reasons why it was decided it didn't belong.
And how has the rejection been viewed? I mean, is there a sense that Paris really finally needs to sort of start competing with other global cities architecturally?
Yeah, there's very much a sense here in Paris that the city has to compete with other global capitals. It looks very much across the channel at London, which has got buildings like the Shard and so on. And this building is quite comparable in size and scale to that structure in London, the Shard. But I think that there is a feeling that this would have been slightly inappropriate, being so very much different from the rest of the heart of Paris. And Paris is made up of 20 arrondissements, these 20 districts that are encircled by the Ring Road, which defines Paris, the périphérique. And there's a sense that perhaps, yes, it would have been perfectly okay to have a building like that. Indeed, it would have raised no eyebrows whatsoever had it been built in the La Défense financial district, which is just outside the Ring Road. But being where it is, perhaps a little bit inappropriate. And I think there's perhaps a lot of public sympathy, not least because in the early 1970s, a building called the Tour Montparnasse was built in the 14th arrondissement, and there's a strong sense that that was a wrong decision. It went up in 1973. It's extraordinarily tall, more than 200 metres tall, and people feel that it has done damage to the district in which it has been built. I think ever since the early 1970s, there's been a lot of sensitivity towards the idea that such a mistake might be made again. And that's perhaps why the local representatives in the City Hall voted against it.
And can you put this into context for us? I mean, how easy is it for new structures to go up in Paris?
Well, oddly enough, Paris has been home to brash designs in the past. Buildings like the Pompidou Centre caused a lot of controversy back in the day in the 1970s. A lot of people saying, what is a building that looks like the back of an air conditioning unit doing in what is apparently the oldest area of the French capital, the Marais district, which has got buildings just a stone's throw from the Pompidou Centre that have their origins from the 14th, 15th century. So Paris is not a stranger. You know, the city is not unaccustomed to the idea of brash new designs being erected in that context. But I think this one was perhaps, I think it was the height of it that shocked people the most. But let's not forget as well that Paris is home to the Eiffel Tower. And when that went up in the end of the 19th century, it was the cause of all sorts of criticism. And there were various plans over the ages for the Eiffel Tower to be dismantled because it was considered to be totally inappropriate and totally out of place on the Paris skyline. But Paris is not a very old city in its current form. Most of it was reshaped and redesigned by the architect Eugène Haussmann in the mid to late 19th century. And so nothing is so very old that you absolutely would consider it to be sacrilegious, as a bit like perhaps you would in a city like Rome or another ancient capital. It would be completely inappropriate to put something brand new next to something extremely ancient. Nothing very much outside of the Marais is so very ancient. So I think there is an openness to the idea of building something tall and brash, but perhaps not this, because I think it was just a little bit too tall. And those memories of the Tour Montparnasse in 1973, towering above the rest of the area, are just a little bit too raw.
Finally, Tom, I mean, the mayors behind this construction, how likely is it that the Tour Triangle will eventually be erected?
Well, the new mayor of the city, Anne Hidalgo, she's only been in power for 6 or 7 months. She's tremendously popular still, and she's very much behind this project of building La Tour Triangle. And if she is so keen to see it through, perhaps it's just a matter of time before another vote is held and the voters come around to her way of thinking. Her particular gripe with the way the vote was held was that so many of those who participated in what was meant to be a secret ballot made their intentions known, and that therefore breached the rules of a secret ballot. So perhaps there will be a rethink. Perhaps it's a question of time before the authorities in Paris say, you know, this will create a lot of jobs. That's a very sensitive subject in France right now. Unemployment is riding high, and developers of this project claim it would create 5,000 jobs. So that could very well end up being the deciding argument for it. But certainly environmentalists, conservative groups, not at all in favour of the idea of a tall glass triangular building being erected in that part of Paris. And some have compared it to a similar triangular shaped building that was erected in Pyongyang, perhaps rather unkindly comparing it to that. But just perhaps a reminder that this is a city that does embrace some brash architecture and some bold design, but perhaps this tall triangular-shaped tower is a bridge too far for very many Parisians.
That was our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson reporting on the controversial plans for the Tour Triangle. Now to end this episode of Section D, we're going to do a little bit of shopping. Now in its second year in London, Pop-Up Flea is a temporary retail concept store organised by Michael Williams from renowned menswear blog A Continuous Lean. Williams is based in New York, and after the success of the first market, and to continue to showcase the best of American brands such as Shinola and Telesun, he also managed to include some of the best British brands too, including Sunspell and London Cloth. We sent Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to Pop-Up Flea, which was held at the Truman Brewery this weekend. He spoke to Michael and some of the store holders too.
My name is Michael Williams. I'm the co-founder and one of the organizers of the Pop-Up Flea, which is a weekend-long market that we set up to invite a lot of our friends and interesting, cool brands just to create sort of our dream shop for, you know, a short period of time.
And that's your second year in London? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's the second time we've come to London. We founded the event in 2009 in New York City. So we've been holding the event at least once a year in New York since then. And we came in 2013 to London, and that was our first time.
do you feel you have a strong base here in London already? Because, I mean, the market just opened and it's already crowded. And we are just here Friday 4 p.m. and open at 3 p.m.
Yeah, you know, we think that New York and London have a very sort of similar mindset when it comes to sort of menswear. And, you know, there's a lot of crossover, obviously, in terms of like the blogs and the fashion coverage. And a lot of the brands have appeal sort of, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic. And so I think that helps, you know, us sort of land smoothly here in London, and it helps, you know, encourage the people to come out, and people know what we're doing here, so which is nice.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the brands that are on the market this year? Any new ones compared to the ones last year?
Every time we hold one of these pop-up shops, it's different brands. So this year we have, you know, 20 interesting brands, and half of them are from America, half are from Britain or from the UK. And, you know, we sort of have a cast of people that we love to invite, and sometimes it works for them to come and sometimes it doesn't, but we always have something new. And so there's, you know, brands like Harry Stedman and Sunspell that are based here in the UK, and we have this guy, you know, making, you know, woven knit scarves from this company called London Cloth, and he's got this crazy loom here, and then we, you know, have our friends Billy Kirk from New York. So we, you know, we have a really interesting and eclectic mix of things, and some of it local, some of it from New York, some of it from all over. So it's fun.
Do you plan maybe because of the success maybe to even expand the market and come maybe more than once a year to London, for example?
This past year, we held two events in New York, which is the first time we've done it. We had a spring event and a fall event, and we're just sort of finishing up being in Tokyo, and so we held Pop-Up Flea in Tokyo. And it's one of those things where I think that we would want to, you know, we want to do like something in spring and then something in the fall, you know?
It comes in nice package, and you've got a bag already. Let me just take you through the process.
Sure.
My name is JP Williams, and my company's Design MW, but I'm here at the Pop-Up Flea in London in association to Williams & Co. It's a rubber stamp, self-inking stamp company where you can upload your own artwork or get your personalized imprints from us. It's a beautiful accessorized for your desk.
Before we talk about the imprints, I want to know which types of stamps do you have? Can we go through some of the product that I have here in front of me?
Well, basically, there's just two types of stamps. There's a hand stamp, which is a traditional stamp that you use for crafting and whatever. And then there's the self-inking stamp that's a perpetually inking machine with an ink pad on it. So basically, those things in several different finishes and colors.
And what about the imprints? I mean, you told me, so basically, do you do your own design then? You can't just select any sort of design and go with it.
That's correct, in the sense that we provide X number of designs for you to choose from in our aesthetic. We believe our type style, we like the way we create our look. However, if you have your own logo, your own design, you want to give an address to somebody's stamp, you can certainly upload your own vector artwork and personalize it any way you want. But we've selected our designs by our aesthetic, and hopefully you will share some of our aesthetic and choose one of ours, but we welcome anyone to upload their artwork.
What do you think about the public of this market are looking in your stamps? Is it your first time in London, working with the market in London?
Well, working in this particular venue, I'm being a graphic designer and a creative director, I've been to London many times. I worked at Wolf Olin's for a very short time in corporate identity. So I know London very well, and I was really looking forward to coming.
The company is called Loft Trading. We're from Belfast, and I'm Chris Tindall, the director or creative director of the company.
Can you tell us a bit more about the products you're showing here at the market today?
The products that we have, they're a mix of Shetland wools and Irish linens, all woven and color dyed in Ireland.
Is it your first time showing here in London, or you already showed here in the city?
No, this is the first time for me exhibiting Loft. We have been established now since 2012, so we're really just, it's like an organic growing company, as I like to call it. So we've been growing the past couple of years, and we're just trying to find our feet in the marketplace and just find, it's a niche, quite a niche market that we're supplying, but it really is for people that appreciate good quality cloth and woven.
You do have some beautiful ties there, I can see there. Can you tell us the prints?
Yes, there's nice checks, Shetland wools that have lovely herring bones and checks, and in the linens are like a 2x2 weave and a lovely plaids and different things in the linen. The linen's a really interesting tie to wear because it gets more and more characterful with age.
My name's Daniel Harris. I run the London Cloth Company, and we've come to Pop-Up Flea. We've bought our own small loom, and we're weaving scarves.
Can you tell us a little bit about the selection of products? Because it's not only scarves. I can see some bears as well.
Okay, so the main part of our work is I make fabrics for the apparel industry, sort of fashion and upholstery and stuff like that. But here, we do our own range of scarves, and these are all hand-woven here in London. But then also, I've got a couple of handmade teddy bears, which are also done in our fabrics. And these are done by a company called Merry Thought, and they've been going since the 30s. They're the oldest bear makers in the country. And each one is still individually hand-done. So all the little faces are all still hand-embroidered. And it's still owned by the family that set it up, which is really nice. And then the bone china that we've got, that is actually a collaboration with a china company in Staffordshire. And they basically found him and said, hey, we want to put your cloth on our cups. Yeah, let's go, party time. And they did, and it's amazing. And the great thing about this is it's not digitally printed or heat done onto the things, it's individually screen printed with a decal onto the mug. So it's, you actually get texture with it as well. So when you run your finger over the edge, you can actually feel the print, which is really nice.
Are you weaving a scarf at the moment?
Yeah, we do. I mean, over the weekend, we're going to be in here weaving all the time. I'll give you a quick demonstration.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco experiencing the sights and sounds of Pop-Up Flea in London's Shoreditch. And that's all we have time for in today's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to celebrate the Prince's Drawing School getting the Royal Seal of Approval, as we heard about at the top of the hour, here's the regally named old man himself singing about the colour of royalty, his Prince with Purple Rain. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye. I never meant to call you in your sorrow. I never meant to call.